his body hadn't even been positively identified yet, and we were without insurance.
Widows search for a permanent solution to a law that leaves grieving family members without health insurance. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the difficult task of translating English elections text into Alaska Native languages.
We're building a bridge of trust and faith between the Alaska Native community and the state of Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What can a tiny piece of dust do to you? It can stop you in your tracks. Studies show exposure to dust pollution can cause tightness in your chest, wheezing, and shortness of breath, even if you're healthy. When you're on an unpaved road, drive slowly, especially when operating an ATV. When hauling dirt, cover it up. Do your part, avoid dust, and clear the air. We'll all breathe easier. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
When law enforcement officers and firefighters die in the line of duty, their survivors may be left without health insurance. Three families of state troopers who died in the past 3 years have been covered under orders issued by Governor Sean Parnell and Bill Walker, but a future administration could change that. These families are looking for a permanent solution that will cover themselves and other survivors in the future, but there's a debate about how that should happen. APRN's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
When Nikki Toll's husband, Alaska State Trooper Tage Toll, died in a helicopter crash in 2013, she quickly found out that health coverage for herself and their three sons was ending.
His body hadn't even been positively identified yet, and we were without insurance.
She was able to purchase coverage through the Public Employee Retirement System, but due to paperwork problems with her husband's death certificate, she paid extra. She only received relief a year later. That's when the shooting deaths of Trooper Sergeant Patrick Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich led then-Governor Sean Parnell to order that the survivors' families receive health benefits. Anchorage Republican Representative Charisse Millett introduced House Bill 66 to permanently provide these benefits to survivors. But the bill stalled after it was referred to the House Labor and Commerce Committee. Committee Chairman Republican Kurt Olson of Soldotna says the proposal needs to be considered more. He says it's not clear whether the federal law that regulates state-provided insurance allows for survivors to be covered. He also questions whether it's legally appropriate to cover some survivors of public workers and not others. He noted that workers with duties other than public safety die while performing their duties. Olson also says it may be more appropriate for troopers' families to be covered through labor contracts rather than changes in state law.
Each of the bargaining units is looking for something like that. It should be something that would be negotiated. And there are other ways that it could be addressed, you know, for example, life insurance or annuities.
Majority Leader Millett tried to insert the legislation as an amendment to the wide-ranging criminal justice bill that's advancing in the legislature. But House Speaker Mike Chenault of Nikiski ruled the amendment out of order, saying that it violates the rule that state laws must pertain to a single subject. Chenault also says survivors should be covered, but he's unsure about the best way to do that. He adds that the state shouldn't require local governments to cover their law enforcement officers and firefighters like the proposed bill would. While other legislators express support for covering survivors, they say it may take more time. Big Lake Republican Representative Mark Newman says the legislature should take up the issue next session.
I know that myself, the majority leader, and others have focused to make this a very high priority when you come back next year.
For her part, Millett concedes that survivor benefits won't be included in the criminal justice bill, but she vowed to continue to fight for it.
To assure that those folks that are watching and reaching out to us via email and phone calls and through Facebook messages that it's not over.
Nikki Toll says it's been difficult to see the bill's progress stop.
To be told repeatedly, over and over again, you're going to be taken care of. This is the right thing to do. That why hasn't this already been done? And then to not even get heard, and intensely frustrating.
Toll wants action this year. She says Trooper Sergeant Johnson's widow faces the end of her coverage in December, which Toll sees as a deadline for the state to act.
We need to be able to say to future families, you genuinely are taken care of. right now, that's an offensive, disrespectful lie. And it needs to get done.
There are no hearings scheduled on the benefits bill. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
After being voted down three times in the State House, an education bill that puts restrictions on sexual education in Alaska schools has been approved by lawmakers. House Bill 156 would also suspend statewide standardized testing for 2 years. KDLG's Hannah Colton reports.
House Bill 156 was introduced by Republican Representative Wes Keller. His original plan was to give school districts a 2-year break from statewide standardized testing in response to the recent failure of the Alaska Measures of Progress exam. The bill contains a caveat that the state could restart testing sooner if failing to do so would jeopardize its federal education funding. But last month, the bill took a turn for the controversial. It was amended to include parts of a proposal by Senator Mike Dunleavy of Wasilla. His Senate Bill 89 sought to bar organizations like Planned Parenthood from providing sex ed in schools. That bill died in a House committee last month, but a watered-down version lives on in House Bill 156. Senator Dunleavy explained this week that the education bill now leaves the question of who can teach what in sex ed to the discretion of local school boards.
This bill does not ban anyone from putting on a presentation or doing sex education, as you said. The only requirement is that they go through the school board to make this happen. In other words, they just don't come in without any prior notice, any approval by the school board. But anybody can. There's no prohibition against any group or any individual.
The amended bill passed the Senate, then failed in the House twice in one day, each time by a single vote. The bill then went to a conference committee, which sent back an identical version to the House Wednesday. The House again rejected the bill by one vote. This time, Representative Kathy Munoz of Juneau switched her vote to yes, and Representative Benjamin Nagyak of Barrow switched his to no. Then Nagyak was apparently persuaded by the bill's supporters. On Thursday, lawmakers rescinded the previous day's vote and re-voted, this time reaching the 21-vote threshold needed to pass the bill. In a series of tweets Thursday, Planned Parenthood called on Governor Bill Walker to veto the measure. Reporting in Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a faster flight to Unalaska.
We won't be doing fuel stops in between Dutch and Anchorage anymore. We're going to be going nonstop.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
A fairly large number of Pacific walrus have been spotted hauling out at a new spot in Bristol Bay. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Pilots and residents who frequently fly over the Alaska Peninsula coast north of Ugashik started noticing walrus hauled out at a spot called Cape Gregg. The Fish and Wildlife Service was made aware, and though that spot is not on refuge lands, the Alaska Peninsula and Basharoff Refuge staff took on the task of looking into it. Manager Susan Alexander was aboard flights last month that verified what residents were saying.
We have since early April seen concentrations of walrus hauled out at Cape Gregg, which as far as we know is a new haul-out location for them. They seem to be coming and going. We've seen as many as 2,000 and as few as zero.
Those numbers have led the Fish and Wildlife Service to wonder if this is a temporary spot or something more permanent. Right now, there are a couple of other main haul-outs in the Bering Sea-Bristol Bay region. Cape Seniavin further southwest on the peninsula, Capes Pierce and Newenham along the northwest coast, and of course the famous spots in the Walrus Island Sanctuary like Round Island. Supervisory wildlife biologist Jim McCracken wonders if some walruses might not be seeking out new ground.
You know, Round Island has been kind of declining the last several years, and I guess one of the leading thoughts there might be that, you know, they've been there a long time and they've probably started to deplete the food. that's within range of their swimming and resting capacity. So maybe they're looking for other places.
The Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't yet know why the walruses have picked Cape Gregg. It also seems that many of them showed up into the region early this year. In the spring and summer, the female and younger walruses follow the ice break up into the Chukchi Sea. It's the big males that distribute along these Bering Sea haulouts. While the Fish and Wildlife Service may study this new haulout on account of its biological interest, there's another reason why staff are monitoring this spot, says Susan Alexander.
The chief concern is that walrus are protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which makes disturbance of hauled out walrus illegal. So we're concerned that we need to keep an eye on these guys.
Cape Gregg is located between Ugashik and Igigik, which is a busy transit spot for all manner of marine vessels during the Bristol Bay salmon season. It's also along common air routes. Planes flying too low and vessels traveling too close can disturb the animals and even lead to dangerous stampedes. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
A mass die-off of at least 40 whales last summer under unknown circumstances caused NOAA to declare an unusual mortality event. Many of those whales, the majority of which were fin or humpback, were spotted on or around the Kodiak Archipelago. On Friday, KMXT's Kayla DeRoche boarded a float plane with two marine mammal specialists who were conducting a whale survey along Kodiak's east side. Bree Witteveen with the University of Alaska Fairbanks said they were retracing a flight they did in June of 2015 as a response to the die-offs.
Yeah, there's a whale carcass on the beach.
Can we circle back?
We spot a gray whale not long after we leave the city of Kodiak.
It looks pretty rotten.
Yeah, a lot of the bones were poking out already, so it's been there for a while.
That's Witteveen. She says it's unclear how the whale died, but she can gather that it may be a calf due to its small size. The researchers snap pictures and mark the location of the carcasses on a map using a tablet. Less than 10 minutes later, we spot a second gray whale.
We got a floater.
It's belly up in the water.
This floating whale will be a lot fresher than the one that we saw. It's possible that the first one we saw has been there for months even, but this one is, within a few days.
How do we know that?
Partially the fact that it's still floating, but it looks relatively intact still. Also doesn't show any evidence of a killer whale attack.
Unlike the third and final whale, we spotted in Ugak Bay on the way back to the city. The researchers think it's a humpback whale that may have had a run-in with a killer whale and become a snack. When it comes to less cut-and-dry cases than predator and prey situations, cause of death can be hard to determine. Witteveen says they took samples from a carcass last summer and tested it for an indicator of radioactivity and a number of toxins that would be present in a harmful algal bloom.
And all of those were negative. Unfortunately, as the carcass was as old as it was by the time we got to it, a lot of those toxins could have degraded out of the tissue already.
Witteveen says the ideal time to take a sample is 48 to 72 hours from death. That would require a quick turnaround and plenty of tip-offs from pilots, fishermen, and anyone else who scans the coastline on a regular basis. Witteveen says that's how he found two out of the three whales we flew over today. Our pilot, Scooter Monero, with Andrew Airways, is up for the task.
Next time I see a fresh dead whale, I'll call you guys and I'll fuel the plane and I'll go.
Witteveen says this year they'll have more funds to respond to calls like that in time, thanks to the unusual mortality event declaration in August and a response plan to address the die-offs. The financial help will allow specialists to fly out soon after carcass's discovery and secure a sample. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
The United States recently announced it will not support an international ban on the trade of polar bear products at an upcoming meeting on endangered species. In a statement, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it remains concerned about the commercial use of polar bear hides, but it won't encourage the ban. The agency says in a statement it will instead focus on mitigating climate change impacts to polar bears as the largest threat to the long-term survival of the species. Inuit leaders and organizations from Canada have been lobbying the U.S. for the last year. Polar bear sport hunting is an important economic industry for the Inuit economy. Delegates from across the globe will meet in South Africa this fall at the Convention of International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora, or CITES Conference. The 2013 CITES Conference was the last time the U.S. attempted to ban the international trade of polar bear products. 42 countries voted against the ban, and 38 voted in favor of it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The state's Division of Elections is required to translate ballots and create an elections glossary in six dialects of Yupik and also in Gwich'in. Those are the terms of a lawsuit settled last year by Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott. But as Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned, that process isn't easy.
Think about these words. Candidates for elected office are running for a seat. What image pops in your head? Retired Yupik professor Oscar Alexi says, not a political event.
I'm thinking of people like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump and all those guys, you know, at the race line waiting for someone to say, go.
Whoever gets to the chair first is the boss. Alexi is part of the 8-person team that's trying to translate election materials into Yupik. He says, it's not easy because the words need to mean something in Yupik, not just be literal translations from the English. So one word in English, like candidate, ends up being a phrase in Yupik. But technical ballot language in English is dense. Something like candidate statement isn't straightforward. Language Assistance Compliance Manager Indra Ariaga tries to explain it to the group.
So we're going to come across a number of statements in the elections that are official because they're written.
She tries to get across the exact legal meaning of the term. It isn't obvious. And it matters that the statement is in writing, but when that gets translated into Yupik, it becomes redundant, and eventually Alexi cuts in.
It's almost like saying, you know, this is what he said. That is his bicycle with two wheels. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
You're adding too much to it where, you know, it's almost like you're trying to talk to fools, and I don't think I like being talked to like that, you know.
Others jump in with solutions to ease the frustration and refine the translation. They know they're working together as a team.
What if we just change kankasha to iga?
That's something that we can use.
The process of translating 300 words into six dialects requires a lot of cooperation between the translators and Ariaga as they discuss the nuances both of the English terms and the different dialects. It's lengthy and arduous and...
It's really good. I like it. It's good.
That's Mike Toyakuk, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that led to the language assistance settlement. Thanks in part to him, ballots will be translated into the Yupik dialects, Gwich'in, and eventually Inupiaq. Elections workers will be trained to help voters understand the materials in their own languages. He says translating the elections glossary and all the state and federal ballots will solve a major problem for some rural communities. John Topitluk translates.
When he was working with the lawyers, he and they found out that a lot of people, a lot of natives would go vote and not understand what they were voting on.
Toyakuk says, as a result, one community in the Yukon didn't get funding for a new school. People didn't know to vote in favor of the bond. Division of Elections Director Josie Banky, who is Alaska Native herself, says the translation process is doing more than just making basic voting rights accessible to Alaska Native communities.
We're building a bridge of trust
and faith between the Alaska Native community and the state of Alaska. I mean, and you can see that. I think you can see that in the way that we're sitting down and pairing up and just kind of the whole process and the interaction between our division and the translators has been pretty powerful to see and watch.
Benke says the group of translators will meet for a second time in the summer. Initially, they thought the group would only have to meet once. The division plans to finish the glossary of election terms in time for the primaries in August. Each of the 29 communities involved with the legal settlement will also have sample ballots translated into local languages, and people will be able to listen to translations on a computer. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Friday was a day of speeches, fanfare, and cockpit tours at the Dutch Harbor Airport. Peninsula Airlines, or Penair, flew its new Saab 2000 for a tarmac meet and greet with the community. At last, a bigger, faster plane will be running daily flights to the island halfway through the Aleutian chain. KUCB's Greta Mart was there.
For years, residents and visitors to the island have been keeping an eye to the sky for the new plane. In January of 2015, Penair officials announced they were negotiating leases on three of the planes and that the airline envisioned them going into service last fall. But the negotiations took longer than anticipated, and then there were holdups with certification.
There was a challenge getting resources from the federal government. So we'd been working with the FAA. They really became a strong partner with it. But it did put in about 2 to 3 months delay just to find the appropriate resources.
Matt Macri is Penair's director of flight operations. Standing in front of the plane on the tarmac, Macri said there were other delays, too.
The training for the Saab 2000 is completely different than for our Saab 340. So all the pilots have had to go back down to the simulator, which is located in Orlando, Florida, and go through a completely different course from start to finish. So they've received what's known as a type rating for the new aircraft.
Last week, Penair announced the FAA finally signed off on the Saab 2000. While the planes are new to Penair and Alaska, they are used. Penair officials said the planes were formerly used as corporate jets. Unalaska residents turned out in force for the advertised airport party, which featured a free lunch buffet and parents ushering their kids up the air stairs to get a good look at the plane. Ricardo Solis has called Unalaska home since 1991. He works for Alyeska, managing the fish meal and collagen plants. He was waiting to fly out on the old plane, the Saab 340, on his way to visit family in Mexico.
I came when they were already giving the speech and giving all the information about the, and details about the plane. And the only thing that I heard that it goes about 100 miles faster than the other one. So that make it easier.
In mid-April, Penair President Scott Blomquist said the company was in the final stretch of necessary certification for the Saab 2000. Since 2009, according to Blomquist, the company has been working on upgrading the route's plane. Pilot Lloyd Seabird was in the cockpit, showing folks the various instrument panels and talking about what a difference it'll make for flights from now on.
I've done this run for years and years.
How is it going to be different for you?
We won't be doing fuel stops in between Dutch and Anchorage anymore. We're going to be going nonstop. We're going to be above the weather most of the time. And it's just going to be a lot faster airplane. A shorter time to Anchorage.
Alan Hansen works as a facility maintenance electrician for Trident Seafoods on Accutan. Like Solis, he checked out the 2000 while waiting for another flight.
Yeah, that's the future right there. That's my future.
His commute is long enough already.
Coming from Seattle, it's a three-hour flight, so the last thing you want is another three-hour flight, so shave another hour off. Very nice. Huge.
Besides shorter flight time and the ability to carry more passengers, bags, and fuel, there's another benefit to the 2000. Here's Matt Macri again.
One of the benefits that you won't notice here on the ground is how quiet it is. We did a little test on our flight into here today, and we were having a comfortable conversation four rows apart without having to yell. It'll be great for community, and we'll say one thing is, here in my pocket, these earplugs will be a thing of the past. You just won't need them.
Officials said at the event Friday that the plane will be in service by the end of the month. Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Greta Mart.
More than 100 people gathered in Juneau on Saturday at the Alaska Commercial Fishermen's Memorial for the blessing of the fleet and to pay tribute to the people whose names are engraved on the memorial. 8 names were added to the memorial, including that of former Juneau Mayor Greg Fisk, who died last fall shortly after taking office. There are now 211 names on the memorial. KTOO's Jennifer Canfield was at the event and sent this audio postcard.
I invite you all into this moment, creating one. We give you thanks for waters that delight and sustain us. Pour out your abundance, help us to be good stewards, and hold us in your safe keeping this day and always. Amen.
Delivering blessings, Dr. Sue. And thank you, Trinity, and everyone else who braved the new obstacle to participate this year. We need to take a moment here to acknowledge that we are not so near the water as we have been for the last 25 years. Imagine what this view is like during a normal tide. As such, the Memorial Board reluctantly thinks it is best to move the wall, specifically to a spot at the proposed Oceans Interpretive Center on the site of the old subport, where the connection to the water will be direct and unobscured. No one is eager to move a grave, but we feel it is what would be best for the memorial and its families.
The fishermen and women being blessed today will always have a smile on their face whenever they swap stories of fishing in the sea. I think the poet Alfred Lloyd Tennyson summed this feeling of love of the sea and fishing best in his poem, Crossing the Bar. Twilight and evening bell, and after that the dark, and may there be no sadness up farewell when I embark. Sunset and evening star and one clear call for me, may there be no morning at the bar when I put out to sea.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also find us and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau, Hannah Colton and Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Emily Russell in Nome, Greta Mard in Unalaska, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast, and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.